And good thing the rest is shot. And incidentally, if it were a plane, it would engage to infinity, then there would be infinite room to pollute. You wouldn't have to worry about it at all. If it were a plane going to infinity, then there would be infinite resources to replace all the resources we wasted. You see that? And this is where man has been really thinking himself, the practical man. Never mind, this is the thing that's so big. Even though we know it's not right, there's plenty of young people that keep on living. This is called the practical man. Now, I know there are quite a few of you here this evening and with me here this afternoon in another building, but I really like to use a picture that I gave them this afternoon. I want you to think about the screen having a projection of the picture taken through one of the giant telescopes. And the picture that you get is approximately 1/10,000th of the celestial sphere here. And this if you set magnification of these powerful telescopes, they're all covered with those white dots. And each one of those is a star, and the astronomers explain to you that our sun star is a relatively small magnitude, and he sticks out one of these and says, this is about the size of your sun star, one of the little white dots here. And would it be possible to take that picture off for a minute? In the sense that it's conditioning people's reflexes. I want you to imagine this now as covered as tiny little white stars that are peppered with them. And we're taught by the astronomer, one of the little ones there is like our sun. Then we're told by the astronomer that the proximity of these kind of stars, two of these near ones, might be very much like our sun and the next nearest star. And the next nearest star to Earth and the sun, it takes light coming at 700 million miles an hour 4 2/3 years to get here between two stars. That's really enormous distance. So two of these little tiny things in here, and that's the kind of distance between them. Then somewhere near one of those, it might be something like our planet Earth, the one with the sun. And I want to get a little idea of what the planet Earth might look like. And we do have now filters, light filters, by which you can look at the sun. And then looking at the sun, and if you get some magnification, you begin to see the corona of the sun in some waves. Now, very frequently, one of the waves on the sun, the corona, tiny little flame flickering up like that, is 100 times greater in altitude than the diameter of our Earth. So this tiny little flame, if you could divide it into 100, anybody, an architect or an engineer, see engineer scale, 50th of an inch about as small as your eye can lay out. 100th of an inch approximately invisible. So even if this little flame, great magnification, looked like 1 inch, you wouldn't be able to see Earth. We couldn't figure it out. It's so tiny. I want you to get a little idea of the fantastically tiny little thing that's Earth. It's the kind of way we want to start looking at the heavens. There's no way you possibly see it there. But it's somewhere near that one of those white dots. Now, take that Earth itself, which is 8,000 miles in diameter, and the highest mountain is about 5 miles, the deepest ocean about 5 miles, so 10-mile difference between the highest and the lowest. And 10 miles and an 8,000 mile diameter Earth, 10 miles is 1/800. If you have a 12-inch globe in your hands and a steel that polished as beautifully as any machine knows how to polish it, it would be considerably rougher than is our Earth in respect to those valleys and the mountains. So you can't even see that kind of differential of our highest mountains. It looks awfully big to you and I, and the ocean looks awfully deep and precious, but you can't see it on that 12-inch globe you're thinking about. Then you and I, through all of our years going tiny, so the times with very many kids around, take the average height of everybody, young and old, 5 feet would be fairly good average. So I take 5 feet for a man, and we find that a mile has 5,000 feet approximately. So it takes 1,000 men standing on one another's shoulders to make a at 1 mile. So we got a 10-mile differential between the highest mountain and the deepest ocean. So these 10,000 are standing on each other's shoulders. That would be that differential between the mountain and the bottom of the ocean. Yet on our coverage globe, we couldn't even get the differential of the mountain and the ocean, let alone our 10,000 little increments in there. Get an idea how very small we are in this scene where the little Earth itself is absolutely invisible. So there's an absolutely invisible little dot, and I have a voice coming from it, as in the newspaper cartoon. And this voice says, "Never mind that space stuff. Let's get down to Earth." So he says, "Where is that?" We are just so intimate with space as to be approximately nothing but space itself, let alone say, never mind it. And the idea of, I find humanity sitting on this earth and tending to really think it's very responsible how this whole show goes, it's very condescending about this big show. I don't think we have very much to do with it all. And I really feel that we are being successful despite ourselves, and I'm very deeply impressed with evolution and what evolution may be really accomplishing. But I hear a great many debates, even just such words. Last year I was asked to go to, I think it was 6 universities wanted me to come for Earth Day, and I did get to 4, and the word ecology was on everybody's lips, and I asked, that ecology is the science that deals with the patterns of the total life of various species and their interaction with their environment. So I said, can anybody, as long as you're all meeting here about ecology and about man, can anybody tell me what's involved in keeping a man alive? Do you need a mild? What do you need? And no hands at all. So you really find people sitting down to have a big meeting talking about ecology and know very little about it. This is typical and kind of reason why I decided that I'd try to give up words for the moment and try to only use words when I'm sure I'll have a pretty good idea of the kind of result I'll get by using them. I'm going to come back to many other things that we do in view of the long conditioned reflex of the idea of living on a plane. As for instance, every little child is born spontaneous interest in everything, and the question they try to coordinate total information. So they're seeing stars, and they ask beautiful questions about stars, and they ask very beautiful questions about the flowers, about everything. And the parents say, "Well, darling, you go to school pretty soon, they'll tell you about that." But their desire to coordinate total information is very profound. It's absolutely universal with children. The fact that is so, and that we all have been brought up in a world where it's been assumed that specialization is logical, desirable, inevitable. I don't think it doesn't seem to be in that little child. And I say, how do we get around it to that kind of a conclusion? And the next thing I have to say is, what do we know about the human being's relation to other species? Not only do we find that human beings are sort of halfway between the biggest biological creatures and biological phenomena and the smallest, but the one thing that's absolutely unique about man is that really how non-unique he is in the way of having integral special capability. The bird has built-in wings and can fly and fly beautifully. But when the bird is not flying, it can't get rid of its wings, and you see it having a very hard time walking along. So, I'm sure that the dinosaur, he had a tail weighing a ton that he could knock down bananas with, but didn't come to enough bananas. All the living creatures have then this built-in special, but we don't have any of those built-in specials. But what it seems to be about us, of all things, is we just do not have this, we have very little built-in capability, except for information acquiring and a very small adapter with our hands and so forth to do something about the information. We have just sort of a starter, but no question about the difference of man being then the ability to apprehend and process and sometimes comprehend and employ principles. By virtue then, discovering principles, the principles are that Bernoulli did about pressure differentials. You can develop the wing foil and have low pressure on the top and man can fly. So he's able then to develop various extensions and employ it. So if he put on his wings and fly and take his wings off. So we find him then having this very special kind of general extendability, but centrally he is energy but specialized, exactly the opposite. Next thing we learn is that there was a meeting of the American Association of Advancement of Science in Philadelphia about a decade ago, and anybody knows about the American Association of Advancement of Science, it at that time it embraced approximately all the different scientific bodies. And when they come to a city like that, they take over all the hotels, and so the different scientists of different special categories meet in various hotels. By really pure chance, I was going over some of the data about that particular Congress of Scientists. I found two papers which were presented in very remote parts of the Congress, one from the other. One was in biology, and the other was in anthropology. And the team of biologists were presenting their research work on all the known cases in which biological species have become extinct. Over in the anthropological section in another hotel, the team of anthropologists were presenting their papers on their research on all the known case histories of human tribes that have become extinct. In both cases, the teams, not knowing about one another, were looking for some commonality of characteristics of extinction. And both these teams could come to the conclusion, presented this to Congress, quite independent of one another, that extinction is a consequence of over-specialization. Especially that you can inbreed and develop great special capabilities, but you do so by outbreeding general adaptability. And in the universe in which energy events occur in such a way that there are those great stars, energy is very greatly concentrated in stars and fantastic distances to the next stars. The numbers of times that there are large amounts of energy at any one place in the universe to do large things is very much less frequent than the numbers of times that there are very small amounts of energy to do small things. Therefore, these small things happen very high frequency, and in developing, outbreeding general adaptability, you can weed out the things that deal with things that don't happen very often. You find humanity doing this very frequently, let's say in China, in great river valleys, where time and again, the fertility of the valley was wonderful, but they get in there and there's a great flood and they perish. They hope that they'll be able to get on between these catastrophes, great catastrophes. And people build and say, we're not going to have an earthquake here and so forth. And then one of those very infrequent things along comes the earthquake. So we find that when the reading out the ability to cope with the big, which you don't need for a very long time, you may get on quite well, but suddenly you perish. Anyway, here's our human society. Fantastically specialized today, developing the ability to take great amounts of energy out of atoms and so forth, ability to blow ourselves to pieces, and really no comprehensively capable general determination what we ought to do about it, divided up into well over 100 nations around the earth and a dozen very, very powerful ones with absolutely no coordination whatsoever. We don't have any coordinating capability, and they're all specialized, each looking out for its own side, and the power to humanity is very, very great. Now, I said, because I see the child is not born that way, how did it happen to get to be specialized? You don't have to go very far back in what we know about mammals and animals in general. For instance, you can still see today wild horses, you can get a herd of wild horses. And amongst in the herd of wild horses, from time to time, a very powerful young stallion is born. He didn't have to be bigger, but he is bigger and tougher than other stallions. And there's a bigger old stallion that is the head of the herd. And the big old one then challenges the young tough one, and because, as Darwin found, what they call then survival, only the fittest occurs through the fighting of the leading male, and the stallion that wins this battle is going to be the one that disseminates the herd. So this, I'm sure, went on in early man. Anything I say about you and I and humanity, I don't find it derogatory to try to see where we are, because we all have to go back to the fact that the most prominent I know about humanity is he's born naked, beautiful equipment, but no information, no experience, therefore absolute ignorant, absolutely helpless. This is where we start. And you do get some experience, but there's no operating manual to tell you how the universe works at all. You have to find your own way. We're given this beautiful equipment to gain information, but we really haven't found out very much yet. And in the process of making enormous amount of trial and error experience to learn a little about it, we do get powerfully conditioned reflexes. And in view of just the tiny size that we are, there's very many optical illusions, just like the idea of the flat Earth. Now, coming back to early men, I'm sure time and again there's a man was born much bigger than other men. He didn't ask to be, but there he is. And there's a big tough man, he's a chief. He's a king, local king. He says, you're a pretty big character. I guess you're going to have it out here now, see who's the toughest going to run things around here. So they have a battle, and the new young one licks him. So this young man said, I didn't ask to be big like that, but he found the older ones needed to challenge him, the other big ones challenged him because they sort of wanted to be king too. Well, he finds he licks the others. But one thing he knows, and absolutely instinctively, don't let two of them come at you at once. Take them one by one. Nothing could be more fundamental to the big power man who is doesn't have to use his mind very much, but just simply finds himself in a very physical situation and what he calls divide and conquer. It's as fundamental to the very low order mental great power leader, divide and conquer. So he said, now, I've had a lot of this fighting around here, and I'm very hungry. I didn't ask to be hungry, but suddenly I'm hungry. You see, a lot of these people very foolishly ate mushrooms and they died. And these people ate some of those berries and they died. I see when the animals eat these things and don't die, and I kill that animal, it's absolutely safe, and that's great. They taste fine, and I feel nice and strong and ready for tomorrow fighting. So, but I've looked here. You're pretty big guys, and I guess you're pretty hungry too, aren't you? And it's easier for three or four of us to go hunting together than to just go hunting by myself. And as I kill this animal, it's usually too big for me to eat the whole thing before it goes rotting, so we might as well all go hunting together. And you say, all right, great, we all go hunting. So now we say, all we big guys, we don't get enough animals from time to time, so all we big guys own all the animals. All the rest of you people eat meat, you understand? Okay? So, this is exactly the way things have been organized in our history books, if you go back. The tough guys where the king was always off hunting with his nobles and they owned all the animals. And the other people were having to make do with the roots. And there was no refrigeration and no supermarket, so they often having to make do with a very poor kind of a root. But every once in a while, one of these poor guys is eating roots, those are seals on these animals. That man he's just a little character. He runs pretty fast. I can't even catch him. And he's a troublemaker. So boys go out and bring him in with him. And so they bring him in. So, right, young man, I got to cut your head off. And you say to me, you better not cut my head off. And I say, why not? You say, well, I know what your enemy's saying over the hill. He's talking another language and you don't know what he's saying. You got a pretty good idea then. You tell me what my enemy is saying over the hill, and you can report every day what he's telling me, and you're going to do something you haven't done for a very long time. First place your head's going to stay on, but you're going to eat. You're going to eat regularly. So this man said, okay, I'll do that. So being in this county, he's a great troublemaker too. So I'm going to cut your head off. And you say, you better not, because I know about metallurgy and I can make you a better saw than anybody. Can you prove it? You do. And I try to deal with him. So. Right. You just make saws, you understand? And you're going to eat too. I'm going to use purple and gold along with it. And one by one, the people who are troublemakers who seem to be very bright, he makes them all specialists. And they said, now, but you mind your own business, you clear? You mind your own business? I'm the only one who minds everybody's business. I couldn't clear? Now, he has all these strong men around him that he's let, and he's got all these specialists making beautiful swords and getting information about his enemy, and he's really pretty well off. And he goes over the hill and he conquers his enemy, and he goes over quite a few hills, and he has a nice big kingdom going in now. It's a good setup with all these, the bright saw specialists and all these big ones are fighters. So he said, well, I got a young son coming along here now, and I'd like him to enjoy this beautiful kingdom of mine. But I see you're getting pretty old. So you got to teach somebody, when you take on somebody, you find a good one, and teach him about that language. And you teach somebody about that metallurgy, and so forth. I'm now giving you the foundation of Oxford University. I was very surprised that they made me a fellow of Oxford last year, and my first lecture I said that, and I got a big applause. It seemed to be the consensus opinion. So I'm simply saying to you that the specialization simply came about because of the power of man using his divide and conquer and making all the intellectuals specialists. There you are. And he said, all right, as a specialist, I would like you to understand that the purer you are, and the less you bother with my part of this thing, which how I'm the coordinator of all this, but you must never even think about applied science. Applied science is a very low order of science. I want you to be up to the pure scientist. You just lay eggs, and I take the eggs away. You never know what happens. You don't even complain. That gets you a Nobel Prize, huh? And that was the story. And here we are on the way to self-extinction. Because man today still is operating on the basis he's leaving for somebody else. And then he goes, because we don't have that kind of a leader of yesterday, but you do have people who like to be represent people, they like to get ambitious to be political leaders. You have society picking out people to be the leader so they can all remain specialized and asking these political leaders to make the thing work, make our world work. It's far too complex, and the political leaders really have no idea. They don't understand that metallurgy, they don't understand what they're going on it. I think we're fantastically unfair to the human beings. We make political leaders and make them really scapegoats, and there's nothing to do about it. I mean, somebody has, there's no question about the accelerating problems of the consequence of the different ideologies and the leaving it to the other man to do things. Well, here we are in a very new era. I'm going to give you as quickly as I can what I see as total history and eras. On that working assumption that I made about that, as a consequence of just looking at, of knowing my own first child who demonstrated these resources are not usually employed by life, I made the working assumption long ago that, and certainly thought about a great deal in 1927, that every human being is really born and endowed with very much more capability than grown-ups have ever been able to accredit. Particularly the power man was not interested in these things. He's annoyed by capabilities and more or less suppressed them. So in 1927, I said, I certainly can remember 32 years of, oh, maybe, what can you remember? The very earliest memories. But I remember having much more sensitivity when I was young in relation to nature than I have now. And I said, I can remember, for instance, I didn't get my glass. I was very far sighted. I just saw great blurs from 4 years old. And I got my first glasses, and suddenly, for the first time, I saw a human eye. And not only the human eyes, I saw eyes and creatures, and it was a very exciting matter. And I found myself really, as a little child, going out in the garden there and just looking that creature in the eye. I came to the snake and began to look at it, and he seemed to like me, and I liked him, and it was a wonderful thing that seemed to go on back and forth with you. So I put the snake in my blouse, and I would come home with all kinds of creatures in my blouse, and then when my clothes were coming off, they started falling out, and people were shrieking. But there's no question about it. There's a beautiful, beautiful, fundamental rapport of the young life with the rest of life that gets lost. And so I said, how many other of these things, that conditions and qualities and capabilities that I have that have been lost? So in 1927, then coming back to my moment of this new child and resolve, I said, I'm going to do the best I can to try to recapture capabilities I had when I was young. And I'm really convinced that we're coming into a new era. We're coming into an era when there is a sort of a quasi-democracy, and people have a feeling they ought to do things that really wouldn't be satisfying to humanity. It has desires, but it's still very ignorant. But I said, it is knowing good and more than it used to yesterday, and it could be that we're coming to a time when all of humanity really ought to be able to do things very effectively. I said, if I can really recapture what I was born with, and because I am a relatively low average man, I'm interested in what a low average man can do on behalf of his fellow men, not in what a great genius can do. But I come back then. The great geniuses, we tend to talk about geniuses as somebody is absolutely exceptional, born that way. But I said, I think that everybody is born genius and gets de-genius very rapidly by the ignorance of the older world and in all great love, but there is that possibility. So with that as the basic argument, I'm going to review quite rapidly what I thought would be interesting to try to review, going back as far as we know anything about history in any important degree, to go back to early Egypt. I said, I see a Leonardo da Vinci is an individual who somehow or other escaped losing so many of these visual sensitivities. He still had great perceptivity of a child and a drive to coordinate and employ the information and undertake all kinds of design. So I said, I'm interested in what the economic authority, because the economic authority goes back there to the man, the great big man, the sword, and he commands around. I'd like to know how the economic authority came to patronize the Leonardo. I'm going to call it Leonardo's type. I'm going back to earliest history and that early Egyptian time. And that time, average man is not living beyond 21 years of age, having gone through an enormous amount of pain. He's comprehensively illiterate, very little information in the circulation, and so he's in great pain and illiterate. He finds himself being used as a soldier or whatever it might be, and nobody could possibly think of life as being a worthwhile event in its own right. And so the great general rationalization of humanity was that you were going through a great trial, and you were doing it. The worse life was, and the more fortitude you showed, the better afterlife. The great reward is afterlife. So we find in the early Egyptian times then, not only was that the general way of thinking, but it's also the experience of the individual was that there was so little to go around that really could only be enough for one. So there was a great pharaoh. So we have the afterlife of the pharaoh became the patron of the Leonardo type. And the Leonardo type was commissioned by the living pharaoh to look out and get things all set up for his afterlife. And there was and such scarcity that the struggle for life was so great, there was an enormous amount of something that's called thievery. As people just went and took all the things fast, they had their hands on it. So it says, if the pharaoh is going to have any equipment to take into the afterlife, which I'm sure he's going to need, we'll have to hide it under a great iron stone mountain in order to just preserve it at all so he gets in the next world, then he can look out for himself. So they undertook then, the Leonardo type then undertook to build this great stone mountain. And it's also, well, that's enough of that part. Now, you say the Leonardo type, because he has retained his perceptivity, is probably, let's say this particular one, the first man to discover about the lever. And he tries it out, and by virtue of it, he's able to move enormous amounts of stone great distances to get them, to make up his stone mountain. The same Leonardo said, I see a lot of the people are dying, all my workers are dying because they're so hungry. And here's the Nile River, and quite clearly, along the banks of it, it's green, things grow beautifully. If I can just dig ditches from it, get more water in a little more deeply into the size of it, and things probably ought to grow. Then we could take care of more of these people. They tried it out, and sure enough, it worked. So he was in all of our building, there's something we do, which we call scaffolding. That is to make ready. So in the present life, the various things that the Leonardo type had to do to get things ready for the afterlife. So he was rearranging the scenery, employing principles such as the irrigation and the lever. Finally, the pharaoh dies, and they throw Leonardo in the tomb with him so he can get the afterlife and how they were along with the pharaoh. And this is considered a very great privilege. So now there's another pharaoh. And he wants his afterlife taken care of. So he finds his next Leonardo. And the next Leonardo has an advantage because all the people who are still alive who use those levers remember it. So everybody remembers about the levers, and the irrigation ditches haven't gone away. There they are. So the next Leonardo adds in some more tools. So there's a gradual accumulation of tools here in the make-ready. Finally, just to be after Pharaoh and Leonardo after Leonardo, there'd be really quite a large amount of the scaffolding of make-ready for the afterlife.